It's going, okay. Well, good evening, everyone, and thank you, Michael, for that really very generous introduction. And congratulations to the University of Sussex and to the Sussex Institute for a very timely and very important initiative. For me, it's a great pleasure, as well as a serious responsibility, to help to launch CHEER. I'm sure the centre will be a great success, and I wish Louise and her colleagues every good wish for the future, not least because I remember leaving Brighton for London at almost exactly the same time as she came here. We passed somewhere on the A23. I'm confident that CHEER is going to do some very valuable work across a wide range of issues, some of which Louise has briefly introduced. Although having been given this platform this evening, I want to concentrate on one particular aspect of the agenda. In the next few minutes, I don't want to focus on the obvious two CHEERs, widening participation in higher education and the whole collection of issues around equalities to which Louise alluded. There's masses of expertise in both of those areas in this evening's audience. Instead, I want to concentrate on a third, the nature of the university itself, especially as it relates to this goal the centre has set itself, a very bold goal, of developing theory on equity in higher education. How far does that objective relate to the question of the ethos and the behaviour of the institution itself? Step back a little bit from that question. What exactly is the nature of this delicate organism in which we work? I think there's an interesting disjunction as we try to answer that question between the outside-in view and the inside-out view. And I'm beginning here with the outside-in view, expectations held of universities by society at large. Universities at the beginning of the 21st century are perhaps more in the public gaze than at any stage previously in their history. And in some ways, of course, those of us working inside the system welcome that attention. In other ways, it can be a little intimidating. The weight of expectation now is actually enormous, and it's intensified rather than created some traditional dilemmas for universities. As in previous eras of university history, institutions are required to be several apparently contradictory things at once. Here's a list, which is actually work in progress. The font gets smaller every time I give this lecture because somebody comes up afterwards and says, you should add X. But I'm sure a lot of these will be familiar to you. We are expected to be, with a small c, conservative institutions, to maintain values. At the same time, people look at universities to do new things. That links with the appreciation of universities as a centre of ceremony. People in the community like awards ceremonies, commencement ceremonies, and so on. At the same time, they do expect people in universities, especially university students, to break the mould, to be iconoclastic. Lots of the others you'll recognise, competitive and collegial. Charitable, we are formally, in most cases, charities, but at the same time commercial, autonomous and accountable, excellent and equal, critical and supportive. Policymakers look to universities for advice, but sometimes they get frustrated when that advice is more critical and less supportive. Certain and provisional. One of my laws of academic life is that academics gain in confidence the further they are away from their true field of expertise. If you ask anybody about what they really know, it will always be very complex, very provisional, more research needed. If you ask them for the view about something further down the corridor, it will be very clear what's going wrong and who else should put it right. But all of these other things, and Louise and I were at a conference yesterday where we were talking about internationalisation of universities, this pressure to be locally and globally significant, and all the intermediate steps in between that, regional, territorial, sub-regional, neighbourhood, and so on. I'm sure you recognise a lot of those contending pressures. The one I've put in italics at the end is public and private. There's, I think, a particular resonance nowadays to the public-private question. When vice-chancellors are asked whether their institutions are in the public or the private sector, the correct answer is yes. Here's an exercise I do with my students on the MBA. Where on this sector of hybrid public-private institutions does the university sit? Are we most like the command structure of the armed forces? General Farthing, you know, in Sussex House? Are we like the establishment of the Church of England, the constitutional status, but also a faith community? Archbishop Alison? Are we like the voluntary structure, the voluntary society, which is the National Trust, which of course people join, but at the same time it operates for many as a kind of convenient tax dodge? And one of the consequences of its public position is that it holds in trust for the nation very large swathes of our national heritage. For a long time, people have said that working in universities is more and more like working in the NHS. But the so-called independent trusts that now structure the National Health Service, are they really as independent as we are, under severe target setting and always liable, of course, to be reorganised at the drop of a hat? Do we have anything in common with schools? Or are we really a complex private business like BAE, the former British Aerospace? Most of the students, incidentally, vote for the National Trust or the NHS. But I think the correct answer is like BAE Systems. And it has nothing to do with Saudi Arabian kickbacks or corruption. It's because we are private institutions with bundles of very serious public contracts and all of the accountability that goes along with that. So the truth probably is that there are very few pure public sector cases anymore. You can usually find a New Yorker cartoon to make a point sooner or later. Incidentally, and this is another story, another lecture, are there really any purely private large corporations in terms of the kind of legislative and regulatory world that many big private corporations now have to occupy? And the merging of the public and the private in education is not just a matter of outsourcing or the arrival of for-profit competition, which it is, I think, with several of those hybrids on the previous slide. You know about, for example, the recent approval of degree awarding powers for the College of Law and for BPP, College of Professional Studies. Incidentally, I'm going to be very interested to see what the composition of their academic boards or senates is that got them through the eye of the needle of the QAA. This is a quotation from Stephen Ball's high-octane keynote lecture at the BIRA conference. I don't know if anybody here was at the BIRA conference at the Institute, in which he showed how in the schools world, private corporations are shaping the policy agenda. There's a sort of loop between private companies being involved in formulating policy proposals, then being engaged to implement them, and then, believe it or not, closing the loop by coming back in again to evaluate the outcomes. And Stephen talks about the export of what he calls state work to private providers. To what extent is that a dilemma for us? So we are under a number of ambiguous and contradictory pressures. And yet, universities remain doggedly independent places. Look at the view from the inside out of a university. Universities are very flat in organisation. Almost all members have a right to be heard on institutional policies and priorities. The institution's reputation rests every day on decisions made by individuals. Think about that mark you put on a final examination paper, or the decision about a part of a process in a research program, whether it is genuinely ethical or not. The institution as a whole is relying on individuals getting those things right all the time. At the same time, universities have proved very good at adapting and reinventing themselves. You all know the Clark Kerr statement about the universities and the Catholic Church being the most enduring fixtures in Western civilization. But here's another perspective. You know the Standard & Poor's 500, the corporations at the top of the American stock market, their equivalent of our FTSE 100. Go back to 1950 and think about what composed the Standard & Poor's 500 in 1950, and track forward to 2000. How many of those 500 do you reckon appeared in both 1950 and 2000? Anybody want to offer me a bid?
20.
It's a bit like Bruce Forsyth now. We're going to go up and down. Any other bids? It's actually 74. But four-fifths, at least, of the kind of economic engine of the American economy in 1950 are no longer there. Take the British university system and track back to the same point. Three-quarters of the institutions with university titles now have been created since the end of the Second World War. And as far as I can work out, they are all still in business. They may have gone through status changes, mergers, changes of business mix and so on, but we are all still doggedly there. You might have thought, going back to the earlier point, that all of that ambiguity, all of that contestation would lead to instability. Actually, the reverse is true. And finally, all but the most aggressively entrepreneurial university leaders know that universities are about more than the bottom line. Universities were, until the rise of the recent for-profit sector, invariably created by communities for communities. If you go back to the founding documents that structure all our lives and work, we're classic social businesses producing public goods. Well, in those circumstances, what is it that holds this internal community together? Universities are almost everywhere around the world voluntary communities. You don't have to be a student. You don't have to be a member of staff. What is the deal? Or to use the technical term, what is the psychological contract when you join? One consideration is that to be a full member of a university requires more than completing basic, obvious tasks, the things that are in front of your nose. For traditional academics, this has meant collective obligations to assessment, to committee membership, to strategic scoping and so on, and there's a growing body of literature about professional academic practice. And since the late 20th century at least, that practice has been recognised as no longer belonging exclusively to the ranks of the so-called faculty. The teaching, research and service environments are now increasingly recognised as being supported and developed by university members with a variety of expertise and of professional status. Finance, personnel, estates, libraries, information and communications technology, and so on, each with their own spheres of professional competence, responsibility, and recognition. And at the heart of all of this, there is a notion, I think, of academic citizenship or of membership. As consumers, of course, students have entitlements and expectations. But both students and staff have responsibilities along with all their rights within this community. And those responsibilities, I think, include this list. It begins with certain commitments about how we work, how we search for the truth. It continues with presumptions about the way we should treat each other in the context of that exercise. And it ends with submission to discipline, especially, for example, in the context of assessment, where submission to discipline is important for students, but also, I'd suggest, for staff and the disciplines we create for ourselves with our collective agreements on policies and practice. Well, how does all that preamble relate to fairness and the CHEER agenda? Broadly, I think there are at least three hard questions. And as I said, after a couple of comments on the first two, I'm going to concentrate on the third. The widening participation question is often cast about being, as higher education being, a positional good. And there are various dilemmas about a positional good, as you know. As Gore Vidal said, it's not enough to succeed, others must fail. The really serious issue about access and positional goods comes down to polarization, comes down to the growing gap between those with access to this good and those without. And this leads to a famous paradox on which I hope Cheer will shed some light. For higher education to be fairer, it has to be allowed to expand. And as it expands, it increases the gap between the life chances of those who participate and those who do not. Cheer will have to look at non-participation at least as much as participation, and at disengagement and re-engagement at least as much as at recruitment and retention. We do need to find some clever ways of moving this agenda on in a holistic fashion. Meanwhile, the equalities question, the equal opportunities question, is similarly often cast as being about excellence and access. The lazy term of art, and it genuinely is a lazy term of art, is meritocracy. But it's very important to recognise that, to remember, that meritocracy was invented by Michael Young as a warning, not actually as a goal to be achieved. This is Michael Young writing to Tony Blair through the medium of The Guardian in 2001. Excellence, incidentally, these days is a weasel word, I think seriously overused, seriously misused in many respects. We debated this in July at the Higher Education Academy conference. And as a contribution to restoring faith in the currency, I suggested that we should have a self-denying ordinance on the word excellence. We should agree to use it no more than 2 or 3 times a year and never to describe ourselves. But the third question, and my main topic tonight, is about the behaviour of the university itself. Here's the first of 2 influential American views. This is Derek Bok, former president of Harvard, on the university as a kind of ethical beacon, holding up ethical standards in many ways through its dealings with students and employees, its sensitivity in relating to the community in which it resides, and so on. Quite interesting that he should make this argument in the middle of a book called Our Underachieving Colleges. And here's a countervailing point of view. This is Andrew Del Banco writing very recently in the New York Times, saying that a little bit like medicine, higher education has generally had the benefit of the doubt in American society. Many people still regard universities as selfless institutions above and beyond the self-serving rules of the marketplace. But in the American context, that reputation is declining fast. When you think about the abuse of the admission system, several muckraking books are about admission to elite American institutions. When you think about the behavior of so-called celebrity professors, you know, the Amtrak professor phenomena, a number of serious governance scandals that have affected the most prestigious institutions of all. As a result, Del Banco says, American universities may be losing the benefit of the doubt, may be losing that kind of cultural position where they were often given the benefit of the doubt. Did British universities ever have the benefit of the doubt? I wonder. If you actually look at the way that universities are regarded in the media in the United States and in the UK, in the United States, most stories about college start from a positive frame, a positive platform. In the UK, I think especially in the popular media, but also in some parts of the serious media, these stories nearly all start from a presumption of envy and contempt. This is a very serious piece of research I did one summer when I sat by a pool in Ayia Napa and collected everything that was said about universities for 3 weeks in the only papers that you could buy within 10 kilometres of Ayia Napa. And you'll recognise a lot of these titles here. Well, do we deserve better? How can we choose to behave well or behave badly? Now, here comes a list of 8 areas in which this is a very live question. Universities can behave badly to their students. They can offer misleading advice, especially in a competitive marketing context. Take university prospectuses, for example. I think university undergraduate prospectuses are almost out of control now. I get the MBA students to bring along their undergraduate prospectuses, and we do some serious forensic work on it. On them. The first thing we do is look at all the claims of distinctiveness or uniqueness. There are, in fact, only six, and every institution has got four of them. We then look at the extent to which any of these claims could be validated by evidence. Quantitative evidence, qualitative evidence. Very interesting that in 1 year when we did this, we found, I think it was something like 19 universities in the top 10 for employability. That actually means an awful lot of them are equal 10th. And then after we've worked that through, I simply ask the students to sit down, look carefully at their prospectuses for a moment or two, and see if there is anything that is said on their behalf that makes them uncomfortable. And, you know, we could go on all morning. One of the classics is, within easy reach of central London. I think we gave up as we went past Norwich on the left-hand side. Now, at one level, this is amusing. At another level, it is seriously damaging for academic scholarly communities to have allowed themselves to be presented in this way. And incidentally, it's not just text and statements. A lot of the images are seriously misleading. If you're sitting in a provincial town in China and you're looking at all of these pictures of metropolitan universities where you've got beautifully balanced groups of students cavorting on a green space, you look very hard for that green space when you actually arrive several weeks later. And one of my predictions in a sealed envelope is that sometime soon we're going to have a serious truth in advertising case about a British university, and it will actually damage us all. Universities, as we all know, can be lazy in difficult areas like admissions. In fact, if you look objectively at the system as a whole, as opposed to some of the really heroic interventions that individual institutions are trying to make to put things right, but in general, the system operates as a kind of huge header tank. Institutions recruit the students who it's easiest to recruit first, and then they go searching for the rest. Why is Oxbridge so keen on the A star at A level? Simply because it will give them an initial sort that will make life much easier in terms of topping up to that first level. And in this whole process, our very elaborate bursary and scholarship schemes are, I think, potentially poised to follow the US elite system into a structural dishonesty, pretending, in fact, to be about need, but actually being about merit, and being particularly about a form of merit that will enable individual institutions to climb the league tables. A-level points are the currency here. And finally, on this JAG, inside institutions, we can be very snooty about the participants in mass higher education. There's a generational quality to this last point. In the UK, just as in the United States, and here is the classic statement from Alan Bloom, we have many old and young fogies who actively dislike many features of the modern world. And unfortunately, one of those features of the modern world is their own students. And I'll return to that point a little later. Unless they're careful, universities can also behave badly towards staff members. As powerful institutions, they can be intimidating to their members. This is often cast as a form of new managerialism or an expression of new public management. But in fact, I think the position is much more complicated than that. There are many respects in which new management expectations have slowed down some of the more unacceptable behaviour by senior managers. Secondly, universities, thirdly on this slide actually, can get caught up in various species of false consciousness. We can perpetuate self-serving myths. We can hide behind specious arguments, very narrow constructions, for example, of academic freedom, force majeure, and the like. We can displace responsibilities and blame others. And we can fail to tell the truth to ourselves, at least as easily as failing to tell the truth to others. And the academic estate's approach to its own condition can, as noted by many serious commentators, Gordon Graham, for example, in a wonderful book on the institution of academic values, be extraordinarily unscholarly. We are at the moment victims of a kind of hyperbolic professional dystopianism about what's going on in higher education. My particular bugbear here is Frank Furedi, whose work I used to actually seriously admire. But reading him fortnightly in the THES now, you can see he's disappointed by everything. He's disappointed by his students, by his employers, by the university, by his loss of status and authority, by most aspects of popular culture, by almost everything technology has done to his mode of production, and by the apparent death of the Enlightenment project. And staff can behave badly towards each other in universities. There are downsides as well as upsides to the flatness that I talked about earlier. Flatness can go toxic. An example is the academic tendency to confuse forthrightness with plain rudeness. Just read the debates over the governance reforms at Oxford if you want an example of this. These are often presented as serious, semi-Platonic discussions of principle. But the way people address each other and talk about each other is just extraordinary and deeply unscholarly. Here's Sharon Bell, Deputy Vice Chancellor at Canberra, reflecting on a friend's premature resignation as Dean of Arts at the University of Melbourne. Colleagues have been trained to be hypercritical. Toolbox of devices to dissect and unravel the implementation of the best intended strategic initiatives, etc. In the academic environment, very clever people can turn their very clever minds to negative ends. Some odd things flow from this phenomenon. One is that cases of bullying and harassment in universities are as likely to be upwards or sideways as downwards. And that, I think, is a real difference between us and many of those other public-private hybrids that I was talking about earlier. And as Sharon points out at the end, to be effectively led doesn't just depend on the leader. Moving on. Universities can forget where they came from and what they were established to do. It's salutary now to read the founding charters, for example, of the great civic institutions like Sheffield. Compare what was said in 1905, for example, when it became a university college. Very, very liberal set of principles involving a wide range of disciplines, involving a gender clause as well as a religious freedom clause, and rooted very much in the requirements of the community. The kind of platform on which Sheffield could now claim to be a world-class leading research institution doesn't emerge until about the 14th point, where the research agenda comes in. Actually, as a text, it reads very much like the sort of thing that the English polytechnics were saying about themselves in the Eric Robinson era. Universities can also fail the studentship tests. They can not assess and respond to risk. They can cut corners. They can let go. They can be bad neighbours, as in the controversies over studentification of neighbourhoods, which has been a live issue here. Planning disputes can be a kind of litmus test of the quality of community engagement. And I'm saying nothing tonight about the Falmer Stadium in this particular connection. Universities can also misunderstand their relationship to other institutions of civil society. Self-interest can very easily trump stewardship responsibilities and the notion of a wider public interest. At the height of the era of expansion of the British system, through officially induced competition, boards and councils were basically enjoined to look no further than the bottom line. And I think that's a very serious legacy that we're still trying to work our way beyond. Certainly not to look at any wider set of interests, which might from time to time call the bottom line for an individual institution into question. Next, we can misunderstand stakeholding. Stakeholder, like client, is one of those words that's come now to mean exactly the opposite of what it meant when it was coined. A stakeholder originally was somebody who was scrupulously independent. The stakeholder was the person who held the money while the wager went on because both parties trusted them, held the coats while the duel went on. Client is another word, actually, that's gone through exactly the same kind of change. The client, originally, in the Latin term, was a person without the power. The client was dependent upon the patron. The notion of the client having all the power, as in modern theories of consumer dominance, have become completely reversed. But stakeholders need to understand, if they're to live up to the modern designation of really being a stakeholder in our enterprise, they have to have invested something themselves. They have to share risk. Otherwise, they simply support the cynical public sector manager's definition of a stakeholder as somebody who can do you harm. Mike Fitzgerald, the former Vice Chancellor of Thames Valley University, used to say every time he heard the word stakeholder, he had this image of Dracula, you know, arising from his coffin. In fact, doing a really detailed empirical stakeholder analysis of an individual university is a very profitable enterprise. Find out who actually has put a stake on the table with yours. Who is it who is genuinely sharing risk? And you'll often find that there's a kind of inverse ratio of shared risk and noise, of nurture and noise. It's, for example, very clear that the NHS is now one of our major stakeholders. The NHS seriously shares risk with the higher education system. The CBI and the IOD, as kind of representative groups, actually have nothing themselves directly on the table at risk. Individual companies do, but there's a lot of rabble-rousing from so-called representative groups that aren't necessarily sharing risk in quite the same way, for example, as the health service. And public services in general, I think, are serious risk sharers with us. Health, education, social care, the police force now in relation to the University of Brighton's foundation degrees. And universities can be seduced into an inappropriate relationship with government. University history has got some classic cautionary tales here. Think of Heidegger's rectoral address to the University of Freiburg. But we do live, I think, permanently at the top of a slippery slope here. It goes back to being critical or supportive, as I mentioned at the beginning. And in the UK in particular, we're very ambivalent about autonomy. We pay a lot of lip service to the idea, but in British universities, we are also hooked on earmarked funding. Lots of university leaders won't get out of bed until they know that there is an initiative fund that they can actually snaffle to perform that particular exercise. And of course, then what happens when the initiative runs out is that the project also comes to an end. We've probably got more freedom to do what we could and should be doing than we in fact recognise. Universities can misread global cooperation and competition. Simplistic analyses of whether we're winning or losing in a global marketplace undervalue, in fact, the historical role of higher education internationally, which has been much more structured around cooperation and mutual support than around competition and nationalistic breastbeating. It can also be allied with a rather naive, melioristic view of globalism. And from the ethical point of view, there are lots of questions about mutual support between different national systems of higher education at different stages of development. The asset stripping of key personnel, for example. A potentially preemptive Western model of intellectual property. And even the kind of dumping of poor quality e-learning materials, a kind of first world revenge for cheap trainers. And then there's the mirage of world-classness. I've got a different lecture on this, but I'm not going to give it tonight. But I'm just amazed by how we've been sucked into the discourse about world-classness. Statistically, most of what is going on in those league tables makes absolutely no sense at all. The Shanghai Jiao Tong list double counts everything. So many of the scientific papers that you score with in the Shanghai list are actually contributed by several universities. So how is a top paper in Nature that comes from Tsinghua, Berlin and Oxford then used to differentiate between those institutions in terms of a league table? Have a look at the response rates of the beauty contest that the THES system puts up. Some of the response rates are extraordinarily small, and huge fluctuations in terms of the position of individual institutions follow. It is, of course, because we've followed the politicians into thinking that this is what counts. And what does count is all the things on the left. What doesn't count is all the things on the right. Many of the common sense elements of high performance by comprehensive universities, teaching quality, widening participation, social mobility, services to business in the community, support of rural communities. Most of these top institutions are, in fact, in metropolitan centres. It's much easier to do all those things on the left-hand side if you are in a metropolitan centre. They're all conspicuously absent. And finally, we can forget that we're all in this together. What actually lies behind much of the historical success of the UK sector is the concept of a controlled reputational range. This is one of the things that we have constructed historically in the UK system, which is much envied elsewhere. It's important that institutions at each end of the reputational pecking order can recognise each other and have something tied up in each other's success. And the self-appointed gangs in the system actually don't help much with this. The Russell Group, the 94 Group, dare I say that here. What is now called Million Plus, did you spot that? Which is the third rebranding of the Coalition of Modern Universities. There's another group, which is the kind of Groucho Marx group of people who don't want to be in any of the other groups, called the University Alliance. Now, the problem with almost all of these groups is that they have a rather perverse view of autonomy. It's generally bound up in getting a third party, that is the government, to restrict the freedom of manoeuvre of other institutions in the sector. And this controlled reputational range is, I think, in danger. So in our anxiety that a few institutions should win in the race to be world class, we've lost sight of something that the American system, slightly ahead of us, is discovering painfully. I'm going to quote Andrew Del Banco again, writing in the New York Review of Books on the 26th of April. He talked about the quality gap between private and public institutions being much smaller than the gap in reputation. Evidence is growing in developed systems, and there's a serious equity point here, that students are choosing reputation over quality when deciding where they want to study. And as long as employers screen for the same thing, then they're acting rationally in doing so. But they may not necessarily always be serving their best interests. Lawrence Blum, who is Professor of Philosophy at the University of Massachusetts, responded to Del Banco in terms which I think are worth reflecting on. He's talking here about a serious, middle-ranking public institution in an area dominated by very expensive elite private institutions. And he says, institutions such as my own are outposts of serious and bright students of modest or low-income background, taught by dedicated faculty who are often respected researchers as well. There are a lot of institutions in the sector which have exactly those characteristics. And nurturing institutions of all types is essential. So, last slide. What, on the basis of this sermon, would constitute a satisfactory theory of equity in higher education? I'm not sure of the answer, and I look forward to learning about it from CHEER over the next few months and years. I am, however, confident that it's going to need consideration of all of these elements I've been talking about tonight. A balance of kind of endogenous and exogenous influences, knowing what is going on inside as well as knowing what is affecting us from outside. A restored sense of our foundings and our history and the obligations that they entail. A wider sense of the purposes of institutions than simple competitive success. And finally, a constructively critical account of that psychological contract, of that deal which binds us all together as a community. I'd be very interested in knowing what you think about all of that. Thank you.